Okay, so my father is serious about certain things. And he was serious about driving. So when the time came to get my license, I wanted my mother or my next door neighbor or any other random person walking down the street to teach me to drive. But Pops, he wasn't hearing it. Boy, get in the car. I got in. And he starts explaining to me about everything on the dashboard. This here is the gas gauge. Don't let the car run out of gas, boy. What's wrong with you? He looks at me like I'd already had to pull over on the side of the freeway with the gas gauge reading empty. Huh? And that there, that's the oil light. When the oil light comes on, stop the car. Put some oil in the car. Do you understand me, boy? Now, I want to act insulted, but I gotta get my driver's license, so I just nod. Yes, sir. This here, this is the tachymeter. Normally, the needle is over here in the white part. You see that? Yes. But when it's straining, when you're pushing, it goes over to the red. Can you see that, son? Yes, but how long can you keep it in the red? Not long. How long? Not long. Today, on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, we proudly present To the Brink. Amazing stories from way past the red line. My name is Glenn Washington. Please, keep both hands on the wheel, because you're listening to Snap Judgment. We're going to begin our To the Brink episode with a true story that is not exactly true. But don't worry, this will all make sense in a moment. Snap Judgment's Joe Rosenberg starts us off.
So this story is about a woman, but it's going to be told by a man.
My name's Paul Berseller.
He's a documentary filmmaker from New York, but a few years back,
I went from New York to France to take care of my mother, who was dying of a brain tumor, and she died, and then I just started this life in England, and I was kind of a bit sad and lonely.
And he read a lot, 4 newspapers a day.
And I'm sitting in my study with all the newspapers surrounding me, and suddenly I see this story, and that's what led to my first seeing the name Takako Kenichi.
The story of Takako Kenichi was low on details, but high on intrigue. She had first been spotted wandering around a truck stop in North Dakota, 28, pretty, Japanese, and wearing only the lightest clothing, even though it was the middle of winter. Then came the hook. The thing that made the story, the story.
This Japanese woman was searching for the money that was buried in the Coen brothers' movie Fargo.
For those of you who haven't seen the film, Fargo is a dark comic masterpiece about a ransom gone wrong. It depicts the true story of a mild-mannered car salesman who had his own wife kidnapped in order to scam his father-in-law out of $1 million. Instead, the money wound up in the hands of one of the kidnappers, played in the film by Steve Buscemi. Before he died, the kidnapper supposedly buried the money alongside a fence on an unknown stretch of road. In the film, the money is never recovered. Takako had been searching for the real-life treasure.
Because there was a graphic at the beginning of Fargo that said, "This is a true story."
The only problem being,
there was no money.
The film is fiction.
They made it all up. So Takako must have fallen for you know, the Coen brothers' trick.
Takako's gullibility would prove to be her undoing. She froze to death 2 days later in a snowy field in the forest, looking for the money. If you had been reading your own paper that day, you might remember this story. It was one of those odd wire service human interest pieces that was just too good not to run.
Everyone I told it to just laughed, because that was kind of the function of the story. It was black comedy from the start. But there was something about her story that kind of grabbed me. So I went back the next day and started buying that newspaper to see if there's any follow-up stories. And just by its very nature, that was it.
Paul wanted to know more, so he called up the investigator who had worked on Takako's case and asked if he could send over some info.
And they sent me kind of the crime scene photo. And so I saw Takako for the first time dead, you know, kind of lying in the snow. She had a black mini skirt, black boots, a black coat that kind of just went to her hips, and she had black hair and a very pale face. This is very strange. What happened to Takako Kanishi? How is it possible that somebody confuses fiction with reality so much that they actually fly from Japan and end up alone in a field in the snow, very far away from home?
And since Paul is a documentary filmmaker,
I wanted to make a film about it. I would follow the path that Takako took in America, step by step, person by person, because if I could just figure out why she was looking for the money, I could figure out, like, who was this real person, this real Takako, who was kind of behind this, you know, crazy tabloid joke.
So Paul flew out to North Dakota with a skeleton crew and began following Takako's trail, which wasn't always clear. The first person he managed to find, who had actually spoken to her, was a Bismarck police officer named Jesse Hellman.
So I just walked into the police station and said, could I speak to Officer Hellman? And so I met him, and he didn't understand why I was doing this. And I said, I want you to just show me what happened.
For Jesse, the day he met Takako had been just like any other day, until a long-haul trucker brought in someone he found wandering along the side of the road.
And suddenly, through his door, this really pretty Japanese woman walked in, wearing this outfit, and Jesse wondered whether she wasn't a prostitute. He said, you know, girls in North Dakota don't dress like that. And then he paused, you know, said, probably because of the weather.
Takako was clearly trying to explain something to him, but she didn't really speak English, and he didn't speak Japanese. Just about the only thing that Jesse could understand was a word Takako was saying over and over again. Fargo. Fargo. Fargo.
And then she pulled out a map. There was an X, there was a road, there was two lines for a road, and just a tree by the side of the road. There was nothing else identifiable. You know, as Jesse said, you can always find a single tree by a road in North Dakota. That doesn't really tell you where you are.
So Jesse flagged down another officer for help.
And he suddenly realized that this was a treasure map. He said, Jesse, she's looking for the money that's buried in Fargo. It was kind of like, could you help me with that? They both tried to explain to her that Fargo was just a movie, that it wasn't real. But they couldn't get this across to her. They were quite frustrated. But Jesse liked her. He thought she seemed lonely. So he took Takako to the bus station.
And it was at that point that Paul gleaned his first clue about why she might be looking for the treasure.
Because as he drove her there, she was holding her stomach and saying something, and he heard her say the word cancer. So then he said, you have cancer? And then in broken English, she said, yes, cancer. And at that point, I was like, oh my God, this is a story of a woman dying and what she does after she finds out she's terminally ill.
Absolutely. If you feel a little close, you feel it's a little bit easier to get inside her head.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Because, you know, everything that she believed was just up for grabs, and all the rules were gone.
But there was something else about Jesse's story which also struck Paul. Not a clue exactly, but something. all the same.
It was the look on his face. The look on his face was guilt. He felt guilty because after Jesse took Takako to the bus station, he said, if you need any help, you know how to reach me. And then she walked off and he felt really badly about it, that he should not have left her to go on her own.
So Paul kept following Takako's trail, knowing that from Bismarck, she had taken the bus to the town of Fargo itself, where she'd checked in to a cheap motel.
So I went to the front desk and I asked for a particular room. And the guy at the front desk, he was like, why do you want to stay in that room? And I said, oh, well, we're making this film about this Japanese woman. He said, the Japanese woman? What? I said, yeah. Did you know the Japanese woman? She said, oh, yeah, of course. I checked her in.
Then Paul explained that he was investigating her death.
And he was like, what? She died? He didn't know that she died. But she had made such an impression on him. You know, this person who'd come so far by herself, and he fancied her, and he never forgot her. And I asked him, I said, did she mention anything about Fargo, the movie? And he said, no, not at all. And then she said to him, did he know a good place for her to watch the stars? He asked me, I mean, what's so special about the stars in Fargo? And we just kind of looked at each other like, I don't know.
So Paul took the key to Takako's room and lay in the same bed she had, trying to get inside her head and put it all together. The treasure, the cancer, and a good place to watch the stars. Everything felt like it was on the cusp of making sense.
It said in the hotel kind of phone records that she'd made this phone call to this number in Singapore. And obviously it had meant a lot to her because it was something like a $75 phone call. And it was the last call she ever made. So I wonder who she was calling. And I called and no one answered. And I looked out the window at this kind of very depressing parking lot and neon sign. And I don't know why. I don't know what it was. But I just gathered my things and changed my room.
In the morning, Paul found Takako's next breadcrumb, a taxi driver who had picked her up from the motel.
And I asked him what I asked everyone was like, what did she say about Fargo, the movie? And he said she didn't really say much at all. But the one thing she did say is that she asked the taxi driver to take her to Detroit Lakes.
Detroit Lakes is a resort town just east of Fargo. At this time of year, it was completely emptied out, no attractions. But Takako had asked to be let out on the far side of the lake, where there was no town, just forest.
And he did have a moment where he thought, it's cold out. Why am I letting her out in the cold? But like a lot of people, they had second thoughts, but they just didn't think it was polite to ask. And so he just let her out of the car and drove off.
Then the taxi driver let Paul out in the middle of the woods at the same spot.
And there was no sound at all. It was the sound of the wind flying off the lake and just cold air. And I followed Takako's path onto the property of this woman named Deb, who I went to see. She said that she was with her kids in front of the house and she saw this figure in black running up the hill a couple hundred feet away into the forest, this figure that looked like it was a witch. And I didn't know at first whether Deb was joking or not, but she said that she gathered the kids together into a circle and she prayed to ask for Jesus' protection against the influence of this witch. But she was very sad because, you know, Takako passed through the lives of these people just really briefly. She came and she went. And in the same way that I think the night clerk felt that he should have been spending less time looking at her legs and more time trying to help her, It was the same thing with this woman, Deb, that, you know, the Christian thing to do would have been to run after her and run up the hill and to find out if she needed help. But she didn't do that. That's what Jesse felt as well. In fact, he told me, why didn't I do more?
The next morning, a hunter found Akako's body in a clearing by the forest. She had died of exposure, kneeling against a tree, with her face buried in the snow. The last person Paul spoke to was the lead investigator on her case.
And that's when something really strange happened, because he just said something that made me realize that everything that everyone thought about the case and the death of Takako Kanishi was completely, totally wrong. And what it was he said to me, he just, in this totally offhand way, started speaking about the suicide. And I was like, what? She committed suicide. And I said, well, how do you know she committed suicide? And that's when he brought out the suicide note.
Takako had mailed the note to her family in Japan before she died. In it, she apologizes for the shame her suicide will cause them. But by the time the police found out about the note, Jesse and the other officer in Bismarck had already told a local reporter about the strange Japanese woman looking for a fictional treasure. Only later would Paul learn that Takako's map wasn't a treasure map at all. It turns out that in Japan, drawing maps is a common way to ask for directions. Nor did the forensic team find any evidence of cancer. And although everyone Paul had spoken to had taken it for granted that she was looking for the money from Fargo, Paul realized that she'd never actually talked about the movie with anyone. She was just looking for Fargo the town.
And I found out that, you know, the last phone call she made to this number in Singapore was to the ex-boyfriend. And this boyfriend came from Fargo. She hadn't gone there to look for the money that had been buried in the movie. It had to do with following the traces of this ex-boyfriend. It was about something real, something that had gone wrong in her life somehow and had led her to kill herself.
And as for Paul,
I was embarrassed. Why didn't I see the clues? Why did I insist on seeing something that wasn't there? What was wrong with me? There was nothing in front of me that I saw with my own eyes that told the story of a girl who desperately wanted to believe that something fictional was real. It wasn't her. It was me.
Paul had been like everyone else, instantly projecting on a strange foreign woman what they wanted to see. A prostitute, a witch, a pretty girl in search of a make-believe treasure. In the end, if no one helped her, it was because no one had really seen her at all.
So I had her address, and I went to Tokyo to see where she lived, and I just knocked on the door of the landlady. And of all the people who blamed themselves for what happened to Takako, the landlady blamed herself the most. The story she told was of a country girl who had come to the big city and got a job in a travel agency and was very polite and lived a totally normal life.
But then Takako lost her job at the travel agency, and her boyfriend dumped her. To make ends meet, she got a gig at a hostess bar. She began drinking, losing her keys, falling behind on rent, and the landlady wasn't sympathetic. Until one day, Takako left without an explanation. The landlady presumed to go back to the country with her parents.
A little while later, Takako's mother called and said to her, "Takako's gone." And the landlady said, "Gone?" And then the mother said, "Yes, she died far away, alone, in a cold place." And all Takako left in the flat was this music box. It was by the window. The cassette was still inside it, and the landlady pressed play.
The song was a ballad about a man who promises to take his lover back to his hometown, but then leaves without her. The landlady said it was Takako's favorite song.
I sat there with her while she listened to this song. No expression on her face, just these tears. And she just said, I should have helped her. I'm so regretful. I'm so regretful.
Now, if you'd like to see Paul's documentary about Takako Kenichi, it's called This is a True Story. I'm going to have a link to it on our website, snapjudgment.org. Paul Burgzeller, he's director and documentarian. He's living in London right now. We're so thankful to him for his help on this piece, and we're thankful as well to David and Nathan Zellner. We also interviewed them, but we weren't able to include their material. We're so sorry. Now, they've written and directed a fantastic feature film inspired by this very story. We highly recommend it. It's called Kumiko, the Treasure Hunter. It's in theaters now and will be available for digital download and video on demand June 19th and released on DVD June 30th. That story was produced by Joe Rosenberg. The original score and sound design for that piece was done by Renzo Gorio. Snap Judgment, the To the Brink episode returns, one mother's incredible decision, and why people should not mess with tiny individuals. When Storytelling with a Beat continues, stay tuned.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. S3.
You're listening to Snap Judgment, the To the Brink episode. Today, we're speaking with people forced past their personal breaking points. And our next story, it's about commitment like you've never heard before. And it comes to us from Snap Judgment's Anna Sussman.
A young prisoner in Northern Ireland approached a fellow prisoner after Mass one Sunday and volunteered for a mission which would guarantee his death within 100 days.
I was 24 years of age. I was single. I put my name forward. After that, there would be people joining it when someone died.
Lawrence volunteered to join a hunger strike. Was a part of a series of very dramatic protests by Irish Republican Army fighters in prison.
I was told after four had died that I was going to be the next one joined it on the 29th of June. I then got a very short communication from the IRA's Army Council, just written on one cigarette paper, which said, Comrade, you have put forward your name for the hunger strike. You realise, of course, that this means that you will most likely be dead within the next 2 months. Rethink your decision, Army Council. So it was very stark. If you had any second thoughts about not going through with it, but I didn't have. I don't think anybody made the decision lightly. The fact that four people had already died didn't change my opinion on it.
Lawrence is Catholic. He grew up watching as his family lost more and more of their rights in Northern Ireland. They were treated with increasing hostility by the government and then by their Protestant friends and neighbors.
I think it's tragic that I was born into a society where Catholics were discriminated against in the way they were. My parents' generation kept their heads down. I think that my generation weren't prepared to keep their head down. They didn't rise up in armed struggle. They rose up in peaceful protests on the streets. And then they were shot off the streets, and I'm proud that, yes, my generation then said, well, we weren't just going to be cowed, we weren't going to be broken.
Lawrence made the choice to take up arms, to join the IRA. He was convicted of causing explosions and attacking a police officer. And when he landed in prison, the British government had just revoked the status of political prisoner it had been giving to IRA inmates.
Well, the British are saying we were criminals, we were saying that we were political prisoners, and that the struggle on the outside is a political struggle. Then we seen the need to take a stand, and that the idea that we would wear prison clothes, do prison uniform, and meekly say that we were criminals was just not something that was going to happen as far as we were concerned. It wasn't done lightly, it wasn't done fatalistically. It was done because we believed that this was something that we needed to do.
The first striker, Bobby Sands, died after 66 days. And Lawrence says when the news of his death spread, the prison went quiet.
It was early in the morning after the prison guards come on, and it's a very strange feeling. The wing was very, very quiet. There was no shouting or anything else.
Then Francis Hughes, the second hunger striker, died. The third died quickly after him. A fourth man died after 61 days. Then it was Lawrence's turn to join the strike. He wanted to tell his mother before she heard it on the news.
The most difficult thing was to say to families that they were going to join a hunger strike, and particularly at that stage after four people had died. And we were very close, but all through my life, I was very close with my mother.
I think when I first told her I was going on a hunger strike, more or less she was resigned to it. Obviously, she was in turmoil at the same time. And I suppose that's the strongest thing about her. She would never have used her love for me in a way that was, well, you better do this if you love me. Or I started with the hope that I would live, that something would happen.
In terms of fears, there was always the concern, I think everybody, when they're putting their name down for it, what will it be like at the end? Will I have the ability to go through with this? Will I have the commitment to see this through to the end?
The first day, the guards brought Lawrence his breakfast, and he left it, untouched. They brought him a tray of lunch, and then a tray of dinner.
It became more of a torture rather than anything else, as in terms of just the smell of it.
For the first 3 days, I think you still feel hungry, but I think after that, it's hard to describe it. So I suppose my initial memories was feeling cold, some aches and pains, and it was really strange as time went on. I couldn't listen to music at all. And the only music that I could end up listening to was the music that I previously detested, which was country and western music, or particularly the Irish version of country and western music. I think it's because the music itself is so thoughtless, you don't have to actually think about it, or the lyrics are so stupid, you don't have to think about it, that apologies to any, you know, country and western fans.
Eventually, he became so weak, he was moved to the prison hospital with the other hunger strikers.
You become aware of just how weak your body is, and you start to obviously see yourself in the mirror. And you're basically skin and bones. You've got to remember, is by that stage, you're totally exhausted. So it's not like you sitting today and thinking, I'm going to die now, later on the day or in a couple of days' time, how do I feel? It's not like that at all. You're sort of falling in and out of consciousness. Trying to use every ounce of your energy to stay alive and keep going.
He only drank salt water, about 10 pints a day. Weeks passed, and then he began to lose basic functions.
After about 40 days, eyesight starts to go. Seen double vision, but very clear double vision. And then after probably about 50 days, double vision went, and it became just like a blurred vision. The other thing, as your sight went, the sense of smell really dramatically increased. So like the smell of food, and the prison authorities would put the food into our cell every day. They put in our breakfast, they would take the breakfast out at lunchtime, put in a lunch, they'd take a lunch out in the evening, put in a supper. So actually as the food sat there and got cold and congealed, like the smell of it was sometimes overpowering.
One of the smells that at one time I was very curious about and sort of looked about the cell to see what was going on. And what I realised later on was the smell of my own body, where it's disintegrating. Your body is starting to smell like rotten flesh, which was a sort of a stark discovery.
Since the day he walked into Long Kesh prison, Lawrence's mother made regular visits to see him. And she kept up her visits once he was moved to the prison hospital. As his body thinned out, the reality of his commitment to the strike dawned on her. Lawrence says he could see the pain he was causing her. It was written all over her face.
Visits on the hunger strike were very awkward. I know that the decisions I had taken was causing my family real grief. And basically, I suppose all those visits, it's more about what's not said rather than what is said. You know, you end up talking about everything other than what's actually happening right in front of you. Because in some sense, there's, you know, a conversation's not going to go anywhere. I'm on hunger strike. I was again repeating that I was staying on hunger strike and that was my wish.
Then Lawrence's father, who had never visited him before, came to see him in the prison hospital.
And you just look at my father, he was shattered, you know, in many ways. My father always wore a cap, but he had the cap off and he kept squeezing it in his hands and turning it around in his hands. And then finally he burst out about coming off the hunger strike and did I know the impact it was having on my mother? And I said I did, and but I said I wasn't. I wasn't coming off it. That's the tragic thing about it too. I'm looking at him and he's totally powerless. He doesn't know what to do or what to say. It's like the apple cart turned upside down, you know. The sons and daughters are overtaking the parents, even at a very young age. Sort of the parents feel powerless.
Lawrence reached 60 days with no food, and then 65. No hunger striker had lived more than 66 days.
I always had fantasies that, you know, the door is going to suddenly open and somebody's going to say, look, yes, it's over. That's the sort of thing you live with, I hope, and, you know, visualize how it was going to happen and what you're going to do once it happened and what you're going to eat.
At one point, Lawrence was called from his cell. He was told there was to be a meeting with three Sinn Féin leaders.
He said, look, if you were to call off your hunger strike now, the Irish people will have nothing but admiration for you. If you stay on your hunger strike, what you can be sure of is everybody around this table will be dead within the next few weeks. But our response was, well, we're not stopping it.
Lawrence and the remaining hunger strikers, those who weren't bedridden, spent their time on plastic chairs in the hospital yard, staring into space, making occasional small talk, waiting to die.
And we were sitting in the yard, a number of us, on the hunger strike, and started to hear this real strange sounds coming from one of the cells. I've tried to describe it, and I sent it to me like an animal, like a cow or something who had been in distress. I grew up in the countryside, and I knew that it was one of the guys on hunger strike, Paddy Quinn. And they would do this real deep roaring, and then it would change into like a very high-pitched, almost like a giggle, somebody giggling, but you knew this, they certainly weren't laughing. And then there would be maybe a period of silence, and then this really deep, deep sobbing. Heart-wrenching sobbing. I was in a cell just two doors down from Paddy. And the other sound then I could hear was his mother. She was sitting with him. And I could hear her just speaking to him very gently, which was the real juxtaposition of Paddy, I say, screaming, bawling, sobbing, and then his mother just saying, you're all right, Paddy, stay calm. Just generally trying to comfort him.
And then came a moment, a decision that changed the fate of the hunger strike and almost every man on it. Paddy Quinn slipped into a coma, and his mother was given power of attorney. She had him moved to a hospital and put on an IV drip.
Well, he would have died within a few hours if his mother hadn't have authorised medical intervention. I think it was part of me had said, I'm glad that you did, because I knew Paddy well. It was obvious this person was in extreme agony. The other part of me was now wondering what happened. I mean, this is going to impact on our whole strategy here.
The iron will of the protesters had met its match. Not in the unforgiving prison system or in Margaret Thatcher, but in the force that erupted from the breaking hearts of their mothers and fathers.
We had a closeness with our families. We could understand the tragic nature of it, that they're watching people die one after another. So there's a mixture of emotions. There's a realization that this is very potentially could undermine the hunger strike.
When Lawrence reached his 68th day on hunger strike, his family was called in to be by his side.
I remember them coming in, being at the bottom of the bed, and the mother sitting at the side of it, and sister crying, and the father and my brother and sister had again asked me to come off it. I said I wasn't coming off the hunger strike, and I was out there with my mother, and she was holding my hand. And what I do remember is her saying, "You know what you have to do, and I know what I have to do."
When Lawrence slipped into a coma, his mom had him hospitalized and brought back to life. Days later, in the ICU of the Royal Victoria Hospital, he heard a woman's voice, a nurse.
That moment, I realized that I was alive. I was either happy to be alive or sad to be alive. I just knew I was alive, knew what must have happened, and to allow me to be there in the intensive care unit. And I had no real sensation of what that meant or how I felt about it.
He was transported back to the prison, where some of his comrades were still on hunger strike.
And that was a very stark situation because I was still very unstable. I was still very, I could hardly see. I'd be walking with the aid of prison guards. Or so I was passing the individual cells where some people were still on hunger strike, and I could hear the noises that you would associate with hunger strike, which is like maybe throwing up a water, or just sounds of illness. And I knew them. Some of them were close friends. Comments from some of the prison guards was, "Here's another failed hunger striker." I didn't go back on the hunger strike because I just didn't have the willpower to do that. Anyone who was taken off the hunger strike by their family, none of them went back on it again. By that stage, there was a realization that the hunger strike would have to be called off. And that caused a lot of soul searching. You're caught between family and comrades, it's basically down to it. We had a job to do in the jail, we had a job to do as being volunteers in IRA, but at the same time, we had families who loved us and who we loved, so
I think we did what we believed we should do. I did what I believed that I should do that day.
Lawrence McCune went on to write some fantastic plays about the hunger strike. You can find out more at our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Anna Sussman, original score and sound design by Pat Macedi Miller. Now in just a moment, "Hell Hath No Fury, Like a Scientist Scorned." When Snap Judgment, the To the Brink episode continues, stay tuned. PRX and NPR, welcome back to Snap Judgment, the To the Brink episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and longtime listeners of the show, they know that sometimes we tell stories that are not true, but not because they never happen. It's because they haven't happened yet. This next piece comes to us from the overactive brain of writer Manuel Gonzalez.
Stop! He shrunk his wife. It was a mistake. One moment she was her normal size, laughing at his pink tie, telling him to switch it out for the green one she got him last Christmas. And the next, she was the size of a mouse, kicking and biting at his shoe. He picked her up and put her in his pocket. She tried to sink her tiny nails into his shirt to tear at the cotton. But she was too small. She had no power.
Can't you unshrink me?
Don't worry. I'll take care of you now. Protect you.
What the f*** are you talking about? You shrunk me. Unshrink me.
We don't know how to do that yet.
What about that expansiator thing? You said you got the money for that expanding thing at work.
That's development. That's years off. Anyway, don't you think you could like it this way?
Of course not. I want to go outside and see my friends.
Okay, okay. I just need some time. Just for now, let's try and make things better. I'll make this right.
He didn't make it right. He did have a multitude of enlarging tools back at the miniaturizing department. But instead, he built her a tiny house. He relished the smell of sawdust and wood glue, the metallic smell that lingered on the tips of his fingers after handling so many small nails. He ordered one of his employees in the miniaturizing department to shrink down a dining room set, a nice bed, and a few sets of sheets. He had some fun shrinking a refrigerator and a whole shopping trip's worth of groceries. After he'd put all final touches on the house, he put it on his bedside table. And the next morning, he looked through the little windows at the unmade bed, the tiny lamp glowing in the living room. She was frying up some thin strips of bacon in the kitchen, muttering angrily to herself and avoiding his gaze and his cheerful, "Good morning." He wondered, was it possible that they could be happy there together? He wondered if this mistake could be the solution to all their marital woes. She'd always made fun of his clothes, of his job, of the way he allowed his mother to boss him around. Now, he could continue to work. He would shrink pearl necklaces and other little trinkets for her in his lab. He'd tell friends she was on vacation, that she was taking night classes. He would sleep beside her in the little house every night. But the next evening, when he came home from work, he couldn't find her. He opened up the dollhouse, lifted up the bed, opened the dresser. She was gone. He thought, maybe she just needed some time. So he wrote her a note on a post-it. He couldn't change her back, but she would see. Life would be simpler this way. They would be happier. But his note went unanswered, untouched on the kitchen counter. He didn't see her for days on end. He started, in his way, to miss her. And so he miniaturized her cell phone. He put it on the dining room table in the little house, where his wife could easily find it. He called the phone 4 or 5 times a day. But after a few days, she still hadn't returned any of his calls. Maybe the phone didn't work, he thought, or she had left, or maybe she was dead. But on the 4th day, he came back to his desk from a meeting and found a message on his office phone.
Hey, it's me. I got your calls. I'm back in this stupid, tiny house. Let's talk this out.
He missed her deeply then, the way she used to sling her arm over his side as they slept, the way she used to tap her feet to an unheard tune as she cooked dinner. He grabbed his jacket and left his office, sped home, his heart in his throat. He parked the car in the lawn, burst through the door, and took the stairs 3, 4 at a time. He threw the dollhouse open. There she was, in the little bedroom, on the bed, her hair tousled, the sleeve of her nightgown falling from her narrow shoulder.
Well, hello to you too.
What's going on here?
What are you talking about?
It's 1 in the afternoon. Why are you in bed? And why are you wearing that nightgown?
What do you mean? What about it?
That pink nightgown, the one I like so much.
I was taking a nap.
There's someone in here, isn't there?
What?
I bet you called Richard.
Richard who?
Don't play dumb like that. Richard. Richard Weir from my department. You couldn't stop laughing at his stupid golf jokes at the last company picnic. I bet you called him up, told him to shrink himself, and come right over, didn't you?
Are you kidding me?
Richard! Come out! I know you're in there!
Don't embarrass yourself, come on!
Is he in the closet? Get out of the bed! I bet he's hiding under there.
He isn't here.
Oh no, we'll see if that's true.
What do you mean?
Let's just see how you and Richard fare without sunlight, or food, or water. You'll need me then.
I told you, he's not here. You can't trap me in here forever.
Oh no? Watch me.
He locked his wife inside the dollhouse. He nailed the house shut, covered the windows with squares of cardboard, glued and then duct taped from the outside. He threw a drop cloth over the little prison and weighted it down with bricks from the garage.
Just wait. You'll be calling for me before you know it. You'll see.
He came home the next night to find the dollhouse burned to the ground. He searched the charred embers and ashes for a sign of her, but he couldn't find one. He didn't know how she'd managed to free herself. And then it struck him. If she could escape and then destroy the dollhouse, what else was she capable of? That night, he wore earmuffs and swimming goggles to bed. He tied down the sheets, layered the bed 3 and 4 blankets thick. In the wee hours, the sickening smell of burnt flesh jarred him from sleep. He found a burned cockroach on the nightstand, speared through its abdomen by a tiny metal skewer. And out of the corner of his eye, he saw her small figure jump from the nightstand and scurry beneath the bedroom door. The next day, he starved the cat, and just before bed, he let it loose in the house. But he woke to find it, dead, on the pillow opposite him, covered as though it was taking a nap. How had she killed it? How had she moved it and settled it onto his pillow? The cat was well over 5 times her size. She had loved that cat. He didn't want to take any more chances, so he drew a bath, let it overflow, and flooded his bedroom. The water was 2 feet deep. He perched the bed atop brick stilts. He slept without earmuffs or headphones. He fell asleep and dreamed she was drowning in his moat. But she didn't drown. Instead, she climbed atop his pillow.
Ah! God, my eye! Come back! Come back!
But she was gone. He waded around his bed and found her boat, an old sardine can still slick with salt oil, and smashed it again and again until his hand was cut and bruised. He opened the bedroom door, and the water spilled into the hall.
Can you see the white flag? Am I waving it high enough for you?
He walked to the stairs where he slipped on the hardwood, tumbling down the 13 steps into the kitchen, and then, from the bottom of the stairwell, he spied her camp. A small hut, made of a coffee tin and a couple of overturned Tupperware containers. Tiny spears lined the entrance, each bearing the head of a spider, a cockroach, a fly. There she sat, warming her hands at the fire, humming to herself. She was wearing scraps of grubby kitchen towels, crudely sewn together. Crawling towards her, he pleaded.
Please, please, let's solve this now. I'll do anything. I'll take you back to the lab. I'll set you right.
She turned then. Her eyes were red, her smile crooked and wide. He escaped from the back door. He stumbled through the overgrown weeds and brambles, the sad remnants of his wife's old vegetable garden. He pushed his way into the shed, and he clung to himself, shaking. He was safe. At least, until she found him. And she would find him. And destroy him. Tiny though she was.
That's what he gets, Nappers. That's what he gets. That story comes to us from writer Manuel Gonzalez. You can find out more about Manuel on our website, snapjudgment.org. Special thanks to the narrator, Ms. Tao Nguyen, San Francisco's own rock and roll superstar. Her husband and wife are played by Sam Fishman and Eliza Smith. The story was produced by Eliza Smith with sound design and wholly original score was by Pat Macedi Miller. Now you're saying, Glenn, I need more stories. Well, the stories, you're pushing me, dare I say it, past the brink. But don't worry. There's plenty of Snap awaiting your listening pleasure. Subscribe right now to the podcast before it is too late. SnapJudgment.org. Snap's on the Facebook, on the Twitter. Produced by myself and the team that is always as cool as a cucumber. There he is, the astounding Mr. Mark Ristich. Pat Macedi Miller, Anna Sussman, Julia DeWitt, Joe Rosenberg, Nancy Lopez, and Davey Kim drink the Kool-Aid. Anna Adlerstein, Leon Morimoto, Eliza Smith, and Jasmine Aguilera do not. This week's super special executive producer on the Snap Judgment Show is Cher Vieira. She earned it. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting can't be angry just because I dealt the cards. Much love to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, they're the ones who sold me the trick deck. PRX.org. And even though this is not the news, no way is this the news. In fact, you'd find yourself in a compromising situation with that hottie from work. And when their lover comes home, you could climb out of the window onto the ledge just like in all the sitcoms. And when you hear the yelling about, "Who was here? Somebody was here," you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.